Counsel? Since you've split your time, we're going to give you six with a red light so that you'll know.
May it please the court. The board erred by failing to apply 37 CFR section 1.530 and section 255 of the Patent Act when it determined the priority date for the
494. Does this issue relate to the non-instituted claims?
Yes, Your Honor, it relates to the priority date.
How do we have jurisdiction over the non-instituted claims?
Your Honor, under section 319, the court has jurisdiction to decide any issue that was decided adversely to Palo Alto Networks in the final written decision.
With regard to the claims upon which things were instituted?
The issue of the priority
date. Let me ask you this, because I have more problems with this than that, and that is, why didn't you bring this to our attention after SAS that there was a partial institution here?
Your Honor, our understanding of section 319 is that we are able to appeal from a final.
No, that doesn't answer my question. You know that after SAS, this court determined that partial institutions were no longer valid, and if the parties brought them to our attention, we would send it back to the board for a full decision on whether these claims should have been instituted. And you know that, not just theoretically, because you did this distinctly in another case recently, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
In fact, you provided supplemental briefing to us on that issue. Why didn't you do it here? We could have had these claims sent back to the board under SAS because a partial institution is no longer valid.
Our understanding was that Section 319 and the presumption of reviewability of a final written decision gave the court jurisdiction.
Have we ever done that with regard to a final decision not to institute?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. However, the issue...
When we do it, it's because there's a final decision to institute, and there are collateral issues about institution that we've determined merge into the final decision. You don't have a final decision here on these claims. You have a final decision on other claims that mention this collateral issue, but this collateral issue never merged into a final decision on these uninstituted claims. Did it?
The priority issue relates directly to the grounds 1 through 4. So,
of claims that the board actually decided? No,
that the board didn't decide those.
That were not instituted.
That were not instituted.
So, we don't have jurisdiction over those claims. Some people may disagree. I don't see how we do. You could have saved yourself if you would have filed an SAS letter. But why shouldn't we find that waived now? I mean, this is months after SAS, when you were not only on constructive notice of the decision by having it out there, but you have following that procedure in other cases.
Your Honor, the briefing in the other case was at the request of the court.
Shouldn't that have put you on notice? I mean, I don't understand why you didn't identify the fact that this had an SAS problem.
Your Honor, perhaps it was a mistaken belief, but our belief and understanding was that the court would have jurisdiction to decide.
Based on what? Can you cite me a single case where we reviewed non-institution?
I cannot, Your Honor, but again, our understanding is that because the board reached the priority date issue in the final written decision.
Is there any reason why the board even touched on that? I mean, I agree with you that the board addressed the priority issue. It seemed to me entirely gratuitous and irrelevant to the issues that were before the board.
Your Honor, there were several issues that were disputed at the stage of oral argument. The priority date of the Martin reference was disputed and related to the priority date. I had re-raised the Tubal PCT issue, which goes
Tubal,
to the non-instituted
grounds. Tubal was raised in the original petition, but the board didn't institute on that.
Correct, Your Honor. So the issues that were live for the court were, one, I argued that the priority date determination was preliminary at the institution stage and should be revisited by the board. Two, the issue of the priority, the prior art status of the Martin reference was disputed and related to the priority date of the patent. If the court...
So the board entertained arguments on claims that it didn't institute?
Yes, Your Honor. And so the problem...
But it still didn't institute, though.
No, but the only issue as to the first ground that was not instituted...
We don't have a final written decision whether these claims are valid or not.
No, Your Honor, we do not. We have a final written decision on the priority date. And, Your Honor, if...
If that had been the only thing going on, none of these other cases where they'd actually been instituted were at issue. And so the board just looked at these specific claims, said, your prior art reference is no good because of the priority date. We're not going to institute. Do you think that would have been reviewable?
No, Your Honor, probably not. The issue we
and
have
so
here
the
is...
fact that they repeated that preliminary threshold decision in their final decision somehow makes it reviewable, even though it doesn't relate to any claims on which the IPRs were instituted?
Well, Your Honor, the challenge for Palo Alto Networks, of course, as you can understand, is the final written decision has different effect from an issue preclusion standpoint, for example, from an estoppel standpoint, than a preliminary decision whether to institute. So we're in a situation where perhaps because of the board's willingness to reach the issue, we have a final written decision that was decided adversely to Palo Alto Networks on an issue that directly affects the validity of the claims. And perhaps the board erred by reaching that issue, but we're still stuck with a final written decision on that issue. So if the court concludes that it doesn't have jurisdiction...
But you would be stuck with that issue if it was done in a separate case where they didn't institute and you said no, that we have no review. You agreed we'd have no jurisdictional review. It would be the same decision. The preclusive effect of a final written decision on an issue they didn't have to reach there versus in the threshold institution decision seems to me to make no difference.
Well, FinGen has not disputed that it will argue that there's a preclusive effect to the board's findings in the final written decision. That plainly wouldn't be the case in a decision not to institute on those grounds.
Keep in mind you're well into your co-counsel's time.
Okay. And so we'd ask, in the alternative, if the court finds that it does not have jurisdiction, in what appears to be a unique situation where the board has reached an issue and decided a final written decision on an issue such as this priority date issue, we'd ask under Biodelivery Sciences versus Questive Therapeutics, which is at 898 F3rd 1205, that the court vacate the board's decision and remand under SAS. In the Biodelivery Sciences case, the court found that there was no waiver for as to an issue that had not been raised, the SAS issue not having been raised before the board or on appeal. And I would remind the court that in this case, our appeal briefing was complete and submitted before SAS was decided. Now, I take your point, Judge Hughes, that this is an issue that we were aware of. We may have had a mistaken understanding that we could appeal the final written decision, but would request that the court vacate and remand for the board to enter final written decision on all proposed grounds under SAS. That would be in full conformance with Biodelivery Sciences, and this court has not, to my knowledge, found waiver on the SAS issue because it was a substantially significant change in the law. And here we have a fact that distinguishes our case even further.
Of course, we haven't found waiver because people have either raised it in a timely fashion or haven't bothered to argue it at all. Here, it's some, I don't know, 8 or 9 months after the decision, you were expressly on notice of it, you submitted a supplemental brief on the exact same issue in another case, and you are now raising it for the first time at oral argument without even submitting any kind of supplemental brief or letter to us. And only, I suspect, at my notice of the issue.
Your Honor, the difference is that there was no final written decision as we have here on an issue that the board reached that facially under 319 is appealable. I'll reserve our remaining time.
Did you have split time? How is that going to work? I'm sorry.
Wait, are you going to argue against him and then he's going to get up and somebody else is going to get argue on the merits?
He's a solicitor.
I know who he is.
So he's on the cross appeal for us.
Okay.
And I'm arguing the appeal from
Palette Networks. I'm just confused because he's sitting over there.
We're both confused by that. If you sit with me, it'd be kind of weird him being against me, but so we did it that way.
So what's the timing now then?
I'm going to do 12 minutes here. I'm going to talk about Palette Networks' appeal on the claims that were confirmed valid and our cross-appeal, the ones that were in the final written decision invalid.
What was the 6 and 6 split?
That was...
My understanding, Mr. Armin was doing 6, PTO was doing 3.
Wait, so he is on his side.
Yes. I'm addressing claims 1, 2, and 6.
On the merits.
1, 2, and 6, yeah.
What are you going to address now? Are you going to address the merits of...
I'll address that.
They're the appellee on these claims. Okay.
Yes. And this issue...
So you're going to argue on the merits why the board was wrong, and then
yes.
They're both going to get up and argue why the board was right.
Of course, the solicitor's time's been eaten.
Go ahead.
May I please, Court?
Before you get to the merits, I don't know if this issue even relates to your case or not. It's a little confusing because there's a bunch of parties and some of them went away. Does what I just discussed with your friend relate to your appeal?
Not to our appeal, but it is our opposition. We agree with Your Honor
that
they waive... their appeal under the four grounds that were not
priority.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, if they had properly preserved an SAS issue, I think would you agree we would have been compelled to vacate and remand under the Supreme Court precedent?
Yeah, as this court has interpreted SAS, I mean, when I first read SAS, it said if all claims are instituted, but now I know this court has said all claims and all grounds. So all grounds are not instituted. So
although this is different claims too, it's not just different grounds.
I believe all the claims were instituted in this case on the swimmer reference, but not on all grounds. There are 6 grounds that Palo Alto Networks petitioned on. 2 of them were instituted, 4 were not
on
the claims. But the one with the priority issues, those are 4 grounds that they did not institute on. So under this court's precedent, I think it would have been properly remanded back for the board to look at it. But as we mentioned in our brief, it's not right for an appeal because they didn't decide a final written decision on those 4 grounds. Since SAS came out, I was here. We argued this in this very same courtroom with Finjen and Mr. O'Ryan, Armin.
In that case, we actually did
remand
the uninstituted claim.
That's correct. We had supplemental briefing. We argued in that case that we thought there was no harm, no foul, but it was remanded nonetheless. So
what harm is there to hear? I mean, you know, I think if you were making a positive case for waiver, you have a really, really good one.
Yep.
But what real harm is there here to you if we do the same thing we did in the other case?
Well, the harm is the kind of the whole procedure of what happened in this case. The harm is that the Palo Alto Networks did not raise this on appeal.
A harm is, Your Honor, that I don't know much, but I know a barrel when I see my opposing counsel over it.
Well, that's a good way of looking at it. I mean, I'm seeing the catbird seat. I don't want to give that seat up. That would be the harm, Your Honor.
I don't need to hear any more on that.
That's fine. So let me talk a little bit about what happened down below on the merits as to the claims that were found about the method claims. Every bit of evidence that was relied on by the board was put forward in a reply and rebuttal and an oral argument. It was not put in a timely manner. And so we raised that. We moved to strike all that evidence. And you look at the solicitor's brief. He said, well, it was our fault. We should have tried harder to get rid of that evidence. Well, we did. The fact is that the evidence came in late. We moved to strike it, and the board rejected it. They basically are punishing Finjen in this case for not divining what they would rely on in late evidence, evidence that came in after the petition, evidence came in after our opposition. So it's something that if you took that evidence away, there's absolutely no grounds, no factual grounds to actually invalidate those claims. The principal argument, aside from the timing issue, and the fact that it was improper evidence was claim construction. The term list of suspicious computer operations was construed in such a way that it reads out any type of meaning to what the word suspicious means. The board interpreted that means a list of all operations in the downloadable code which could ever be deemed potentially hostile. Now, what Finjen proposed was a list of computer operations deemed suspicious or potentially harmless. You had to determine that those operations might, that they're suspicious. It's not that they could possibly be suspicious, that they have been deemed suspicious.
What's the difference between suspicious and potentially harmful?
None. We said in our reply brief, we agree that they're the same thing. Mm-hmm. But what the board did was as a list of all operations that could ever be deemed. In other words, it's kind of like the prior art Schwimmer looked at every single operation that came in and wrote that to a log file. Every single operation. It didn't make a determination whether that was suspicious or not. It just wrote it to a log file. And then they said, well, there's going to be suspicious operations in that log file, so that list is included in the file itself. But it never made a determination, never deemed it suspicious. It just wrote it in as a default.
Well, there was some indication by function as to whether there was some reason to be concerned about some of these things.
Yeah, they looked at the DOS files and said there's a certain class of DOS files where this suspicious activity tends to reside. Mm-hmm. But a lot of those DOS files are not suspicious. I mean, they're in that class of DOS reads, and that came in rebuttal as well. It was in the original petition. That was late evidence as well. But the fact that they took a construction that was pretty straightforward and turned it on its head and based it upon a portion of the specification of a great-grandparent application of an embodiment where the actual language was the code scanner may generate the DSP data as a list of all operations in the downloadable could be hostile. So they're saying that it may generate the DSP data. It wasn't defining what the suspicious computer operations were.
But in any list of things considered suspicious, there will always be things that are not harmful because suspicious means that it might be.
Right.
But then again, it might not be. So it's just, these are things that raise a red flag, and maybe some of them are okay, some of them are not.
I'm
having trouble making the distinction that I think you're trying to argue.
What we're trying to say is the way the claim was drafted, the patentee decided that the downloadable security profile data mm-hmm. contains a list of suspicious computer operations. So a list of suspicious computer operation has to mean something. It has to be the word suspicious or potentially hostile, as you said.
Operation. Red flag.
It's a red flag.
Yeah.
So
not necessarily a virus or malware or anything else.
It's a red suspicious. Flag. Yes. There has to be something. Has to be deemed there. It just can't be. My favorite example, and we throw these out every now and then in district court when we talk about this issue. If you go to a football stadium. And you say, give me a list of all the redheaded women there. And they just give you a list of all the women. Well, you have a list of all the redheaded women as well. But you also have the blondes and brunettes and everything else. So that's what Schwimmer is doing here. It's giving a list of, it's just logging everything in this log file, regardless of what it is. It's based on the fact that it's a woman, or in this case, a certain DOS file. It doesn't try to do anything to deem it suspicious or not. So that's if you give it the proper construction, there's no way Schwimmer would come close. The same is true with, you know, when the solicitor's brief said there's no distinction in that grandparent patent, 194 patent, between operations that have been deemed potentially hostile and those that could ever be deemed potentially hostile. And that's the crux of the argument right there. Those that have been deemed potentially hostile and those that could ever be deemed potentially hostile. That's a big distinction. According to the board, there's no distinction between those two. And that's where the claim construction issue falls apart. Now, with respect to the board's argument that even if you were to assume the construction that Finjan proposed, Schwimmer would still find those meta claims invalid. That is a reading of Schwimmer that it just doesn't apply. Schwimmer is very clear. It looks at every one of those DOS files. It writes it to a log file. It doesn't do anything to determine if it's suspicious, and it doesn't do anything to say that you would have a list of suspicious operations in this database. So unless you have any further questions, I'll sit down and hold on. I'll let one of these folks talk, and I'll come back up. That's okay. Thank you.
Your Honor, how much time do I have left? Is it 6 minutes?
You essentially, he took nine.
Nine and a half, as I recall.
Three over, so there was supposed to be six over rebuttals, so I don't know if we're going to let you go.
I would say give it four.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll take a few minutes and then yield to Mr. McBride. Mr. Andre identifies two issues that he claims are claim construction issues, but we would submit that beyond the fact that the board properly construed the claims in light of the specification, that this is really a substantial evidence question and at best harmless error. The board made alternative findings of fact on both of the issues regarding both of these claim construction limitations, and those fact findings provide a basis for the board's conclusion that these claims 1, 2, and 6 would be invalid, even under the constructions that Mr. Andre is espousing. At Appendix 3569 to 3570, the board said first, with respect to a list of suspicious computer operations, that Schwimmer discloses deriving security profile data, including a list of suspicious computer operations, even under patent owner's proposed construction. Then it went on to explain that because Schwimmer teaches generation of audit records for the interrupt 21H DOS function, that Schwimmer is deriving a list of suspicious computer operations based upon a particular type of operating system function. When you look into the specification the board found, and again, this is the priority specification for the 194 patent, you find that what the specification describes as a list of suspicious computer operations are specifically things like operating system functions. And Schwimmer, as the board found at Appendix 3569, only logs into the audit file particular types of operating system functions for the DOS operating system. So there's already substantial evidence supporting the board's alternative finding that under Finjan's proposed construction, the claims 1, 2, and 6 are still invalid. Similarly,
tell me why you think claims 10, 11, 15 should be treated the same as the method claims.
Your Honor, this is a situation where there is an issue of claim construction here. Claim 10 is a system claim. We argued in our petition that claim 10 has the same scope as claim 1. There's two system limitations.
Did you ask for a claim construction of scanner and database manager before the board?
No, Your Honor, we did not. We argued in our petition that...
So that issue is not before us. We're a court of review.
Right. Neither party asked for an express construction on that.
All right. So then again, tell me why claims 10, 11, and 15 should be treated the same as 1, 2, and 6 when 10, 11, 15 recite structure that's not present in 1, 2, and 6.
The argument made in the petition, Your Honor, was that Claim 10 recites two system limitations, that those terms don't show up anywhere in the disclosures that provide support, and you have a downloadable scanner for deriving DSP data,
but that's a piece
database
of structure
for storing.
That's a piece of structure, a scanner.
And yes, that term is a structural term.
And the board said that's missing in the Schwimmer reference.
Our argument, Your Honor, was that anything that performs the claim method would suffice to satisfy that limitation. And I would like to yield some time to Mr.
Okay.
McBride.
Thank you.
Talk fast, Mr. McBrown.
I'll do my best. I'll try and keep it short. Good afternoon. May it please the court. There's just two issues I'd like to address. The first is Finjen's argument that petitioners relied on late presented evidence. I think it would be helpful just to lay out how the claim construction issue of this deeming limitation first came up. Petitioner filed their petition.
I hate to take you away from your argument.
It's fine.
Particularly because I'm going to ask you a question that you didn't brief. And you're not on this appeal. But with regards to the appealability of the effective date issue, do you think the office has a position over on whether we could review that issue in a non-instituted claims, even though it mentioned it collaterally in a final decision regarding other claims?
Unfortunately, I'm not prepared to give a position on behalf of the agency for you today, so I apologize for that.
I don't have any other questions.
Would you like me to continue with 30 seconds left? Basically,
no, you're 30 seconds over it.
I'm over. Actually. Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
I'll give you another 30 seconds.
30 seconds, thank you. Their argument that the claims require this deeming limitation wasn't brought up to the board until after they instituted inter parte review. It was brought up in their patent owner response. So the first time that petitioners could respond to that argument was in their reply, and they did so with the expert declaration. So I think it was perfectly acceptable for that evidence to come in when it did. And Finjen had an opportunity to file a SIR reply, request a SIR reply, request rehearing, and further test that argument if they desire to. So unless there's further questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you, counsel.
And let me just address what the solicitor's office just talked about with the claim construction. As your honors know, when a petition is made against a patent owner, there's a petition is filed with the board, and there's an optional preliminary response by the patent owner. And the optional response is that it's optional. It's not the time to prove your hand, you can file it or not file it. We filed a preliminary response, and the certain grounds were instituted on. At that point, after there's institution, that's when the patent owner does give its claim construction. That's the time to do it. That's when you rubber meets the road right there. That's the time. The fact that the board is now saying that was untimely. In fact, in the brief, the board called it late. It was late presentation of claim construction. I wrote that down. I thought that was a very unusual position for a disinterested decider to make. That's what the board's supposed to be. They're supposed to be disinterested. It's unusual that they're here in an advocacy position against Finjen, but that's...
Well, they have a statutory right to intervene to defend the board's decision. I don't know how unusual that is. Congress gave them that right in the statute.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I know this court's already decided that.
I mean, there's a difference between the board and the solicitor's office.
Right.
But agencies often have attorneys that defend an administrative body's decision. We review the Merit Systems Protection Board, and their attorneys defend it. So to call it unusual, I think, is not to give accord to Congress's intent.
I guess when I say it's unusual, it's unusual at the advocacy position that they're taking that this will be a late claim construction when it is actually the exact time you're supposed to give a claim construction. You know, there's advocacy that they have a statutory right to defend what the Congress gave them. But to come in here and say that somehow Finjen failed to do a SIR reply, that Finjen failed to move to...
You really want to use your time on this? You're welcome.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm on a soapbox every now and then. I apologize.
Tell us a little bit about Claim 10, 11, 15.
Okay, Claim 10, 11. So, as your honor pointed out, it is to require structure. And that was an evidentiary issue. The Palo Alto Network's own expert said there's no structure that would equate to a downloadable scanner.
But the board's reasoning on this seems pretty contradictory, doesn't it? I mean, it seems like the board says the emulator and swimmer acts as a scanner, but it doesn't necessarily disclose that it is a scanner.
if it's acting as a scanner, I mean, isn't most software stuff written in terms of function? So if it's acting as a scanner, it is a scanner.
Well, I think in this particular instance, what the board relied on was the evidence that was presented.
And the evidence, well, I get you. If they would have just said there's nothing in Swimmer that looks like a scanner, you'd be much firmer ground. But when they said the emulator functions as a scanner, but then goes on to say, but it doesn't disclose a scanner, that seems to be inconsistent reasoning.
Well, in this particular instance, the petitioner has the burden of proof to provide it is a scanner, and their expert said it wasn't. So it is an evidentiary issue to start off with. Secondly, there's a conflation of where the board found logic on the method claims. They basically said that the writing to a log file both operated as the scanner and the manager, the database manager, a single writing to a log file. They conflate two very distinct structural elements into a single act. So the structure provided in the system claims does take it outside of Swimmer much further. Method claims themselves does as well if you give a proper claim construction and you look at Swimmer for what it is. If there's no further questions, I know everyone ran through some time. So thank you much. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.